Boost your self-care routine this fall with Fresh Thyme Market's Vitamins and Body Care Sale. Take advantage of big savings and enjoy 30% off all wellness items department-wide from Wednesday, October 15th to Tuesday, the 21st. Take better care of you and your wallet with savings on nourishing skincare, immune-boosting supplements, and plant-based protein powder. Stop by your neighborhood Fresh Thyme Market today, where healthy living is made easy.
Welcome to The Deep Dive, where we take a massive stack of sources, articles, and research, and basically distill it all down to the most compelling story and the most surprising facts you need to know. Today, we are immersing ourselves fully in the soundscape of Iron and Wine, which is, at its core, the remarkable musical project of one Samuel Irvin Beam.
That's right, Sam Beam.
And our mission today, well, it's to trace an evolution that's so profound, it almost feels like we're talking about two completely different artists.
It really does.
I mean, picture this. When Iron and Wine first appeared, back in the early 2000s, Beam was like the definitive, intimate, whispering, lo-fi acoustic guy.
Oh, absolutely. The heir to Nick Drake, that kind of fragile sound.
Exactly. But then you fast forward.
And suddenly you're listening to a Billboard Top 5 artist, someone commanding these massive, full band arrangements.
Yeah, with like complex jazz harmonies, R&B grooves, even brass sections.
Right, so the big question is, how do you make that leap?
Right.
How do you go from that four-track home intimacy to this huge, sophisticated production? And importantly, keep the fans who loved that initial whisper.
That's the core of what we're digging into today. It's almost a perfect case study, really, how an artist can grow their sound, their commercial reach, like exponentially, while somehow holding on to that unique, searching quality in the songwriting. We're looking at a career defined by these really deliberate, calculated sonic shifts.
And fascinating genre exploration. Tons of collaboration.
Yeah, rich collaborations.
And this journey, it really speaks directly to you, the learner, who values those subtle details, you know, the complexity, that strategic shift in direction.
Yeah.
We'll be tracking his surprising academic background.
Right, the film professor thing.
Exactly. And the pivotal moment of his sub-pop discovery, the key jumps in fidelity we mentioned, and of course, the huge commercial impact his music has had, especially in film and TV.
Okay, but before we unpack all that, let's get the sort of foundational nugget out of the way, because it's surprisingly mundane, right? The name Iron and Wine, where on earth does that come from?
Yeah, the name is fantastic because it's so grounded in the ordinary. It's such a contrast to his really poetic output.
Okay.
So the name Iron and Wine, it actually comes from a dietary supplement.
No, really?
Yeah, called Beef, Iron and Wine. Beam reportedly found it on a shelf in some general store while he was shooting a film, and, well, the name just stuck.
That's amazing. Beef, Iron, and Wine.
It's very humble, isn't it?
Yeah.
Almost accidental. For a name that's now synonymous with his complex, deeply moving music.
That humility, though, it really mirrors the sound of his debut perfectly. Okay, mission set. Let's jump into the foundations, because Sam Beam's story, it starts in academia, not, you know, playing smoky bars.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so easy for that sort of myth-making machine to paint Beam as this solitary, always melancholic figure, right? But the sources, they show his background, is actually surprisingly grounded, professional even. He grew up in the Bible Belt, sure, but built his career through, like, serious education.
That's absolutely essential context. Samuel Irvin Beam, born July 26, 1974, raised in Chapin, South Carolina.
Mm.
So yeah, that stable, rural, American backdrop is there. Father in land management, mother a school teacher.
Visiting his grandfather's farm, that kind of thing.
Right. That Southern upbringing definitely influences his narrative style. You know, the imagery, the pacing of his stories. You can feel it.
But his actual career path, initially, nothing to do with folk music. He started visually.
Right.
Got a bachelor's degree in art from Virginia Commonwealth University, specializing in painting.
And then he really committed. Went on to get an MFA degree, a Master of Fine Arts, from the Florida State University Film School.
That's serious commitment, film school.
Yeah, and the fact he went all the way for the MFA in film and cinematography, it's often overlooked, but it's critical. He wasn't just, like, dabbling.
Right.
He was learning how to frame a story, how to use texture, lighting, or, you know, in the case of sound, fidelity, to convey emotion. Cinematic storytelling and musical composition, especially for an acoustic artist, they share a lot of DNA. It makes sense.
That academic rigor, it totally explains his main job before fame hit. He wasn't scraping by playing gigs.
Not at all.
Before his debut album, The Creek Drank the Cradle, came out in 2002, Beam was actually a working professor, teaching film and cinematography.
Yeah, at places like the University of Miami and the Miami International University of Art and Design, a proper academic job.
It's almost this perfect contradiction, isn't it? You've got this working academic, deeply knowledgeable about visual art, film theory, secretly writing these incredibly personal, intimate folk songs on the side.
Yeah, the contrast between that structured professional life and the vulnerable output, it just makes his discovery story even more compelling.
And the sources are clear. He wasn't like a brand new songwriter when the world finally heard him. He'd been woodshedding for a while.
Oh, yeah. He had been writing songs for over 7 years. Before he even started recording properly.
Wow, 7 years.
Which tells you the material was probably pretty mature, you know, worked out in his head, fully realized. The songs were basically just waiting. He just needed a way to capture them.
And that way, that mechanism was incredibly simple, which is what totally defined that original Iron and Wine sound. A friend just lent him a 4-track recorder.
That's it. That simple piece of gear, letting him make demos in his home studio. That's the entire birthplace of the early Iron and Wine aesthetic.
So let's dig into that for the listener, the 4-track. Why is that so important?
Well, it defines the lo-fi nature of the debut almost out of necessity, right? A 4-track machine, it severely limits your options for layering. You have to make really hard choices about what's foreground, what's background.
Right.
And it forces intimacy because you basically have to stick Beam's signature hushed voice right up close to the microphone.
Yeah, you hear everything.
You hear everything. The breath, the squeak of the guitar strings, the room noise. It increases that noise floor.
It creates that feeling like you're accidentally listening in, like eavesdropping on someone in their living room.
Exactly. That lack of clean, high fidelity meant he couldn't hide behind, you know, lush arrangements or anything. He had to rely completely on the strength of the melody and the power of that quiet vocal delivery.
So the technical limitation
became the core aesthetic strength of early Iron and Wine.
Okay, so how did this film professor's home demo actually get out into the world? This is one of those classic, almost like fairy tale discovery stories that you just don't hear as much anymore with digital stuff.
It really is. It starts simply.
Yeah.
A demo of these home recordings was given to a guy named Michael Bridwell.
Okay.
Who happens to be the brother of Ben Bridwell, the lead singer of Band of Horses.
Yeah.
Small world connection.
Yeah, okay.
Michael then passed the demo along to Mike McGonigal, who was the editor of Yeti magazine at the time.
Yeti Mag, right. I remember that. Sort of a curated tastemaker publication.
Exactly. And this is where the specific placement becomes absolutely pivotal. McGonigal was so impressed by the songwriting, he included one of Beam's tracks, Dead Man's Will, on one of the magazine's compilation CDs.
Those compilation CDs used to be huge for discovery.
They really were. And that exposure, even though it seems small now, it was targeted directly at the right people.
So who picked it up?
Well, that compilation CD landed squarely in the hands of Jonathan Poneman, the co-owner of Sub Pop Records.
The Sub Pop, Nirvana, Fleet Foxes?
Wow. The very one. Poneman was immediately hooked by that raw, intimate sound. He contacted Beam directly to propose a record deal.
Just like that.
Pretty much. It's a remarkably short direct line. 7 years of writing, a borrowed 4-track, 1-track on a compilation CD, and boom, he's signed to a major indie label. Incredible.
So Beam gets the deal with Sub Pop, and he releases his debut, The Creek Drank the Cradle, in 2002. And this album, it just cemented that initial identity of Iron and Wine. It really is a masterclass in lo-fi intimacy.
It truly is the definition of that 4-track aesthetic we were talking about. The source material confirms Beam wrote, performed, recorded, and produced the entire album himself in his home studio.
Wow. Total control.
Total control, but with limited tools.
Yeah.
The sound is sparse. Mm. Just acoustic guitars, banjo, slide guitar, all marked by that very close, hushed microphone quality.
And the critical comparisons that came out immediately were huge, right?
Massive. We're talking about really revered acoustic artists. Nick Drake, Simon & Garfunkel, Elliott Smith, even Neil Young and John Fahey.
That's some heavy company for a debut.
It really is.
Yeah.
And that level of comparison, even with the, you know, technical limitations of the recording, it speaks volumes about the maturity of the songwriting Beam had been working on for those 7 years.
Yeah, it validates all that time spent writing.
Definitely. The Nick Drake comparisons, especially, they often focus on that quiet vulnerability and the complexity of his finger-picking patterns. Mm. He established his sound and his audience almost instantly.
And he followed up pretty quickly, too, right, with an EP.
Yeah, in 2003, with the Sea and the Rhythm EP, which basically contained more of those home-recorded tracks, keeping that same intimate style going.
But then Then something happened that kind of exploded Iron and Wine out of that indie folk niche and onto the national stage. We have to talk about the cover of Such Great Heights.
Oh, absolutely. This is such a remarkable cultural phenomenon, not just because it's a cover,
right,
but because it's a cover of a song by the Postal Service that at the time he recorded his version was actually unreleased.
That's wild. So he covered an unreleased electronic song.
Exactly. He took this buoyant electronic track, which became a hallmark of that early 2000s indie scene, and just completely transformed it into this gentle, almost melancholic folk ballad.
And his version was initially just, what, a B-side?
Just a B-side for the original Postal Service single. Yet somehow, his version became culturally ubiquitous, like incredibly quickly.
How did that happen? Was it radio?
Not really radio initially. It was placements. First, it was featured in an advertisement for M&M's.
M&M's. Wow. Okay. Mainstream.
Huge mainstream exposure. And then, critically, it was placed very prominently in the 2004 film Garden State and its massive hit soundtrack.
Ah, the Garden State soundtrack, that changes everything.
It cannot be overstated. That soundtrack became like the touchstone for a whole generation. And Iron and Wine's version of Such Great Heights suddenly became the sound of quiet millennial introspection for so many people.
Yeah, I remember that soundtrack being everywhere.
It was everywhere. And the song kept going. It later featured in a 2006 Ask.com ad, just cementing its status as this national fixture.
And the commercial reality definitely reflects that. The song was eventually released as its own single in 2006, and it's RIA Gold certified, which, just to remind everyone, gold means 500,000 units in combined sales and streaming equivalents. That's staggering for an acoustic cover of an indie electronic song.
It really shows the sheer appetite for Beam's interpretation, his specific sound. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, that single was backed with The Trapeze Swinger and Naked As We Came, tracks that were recorded for Radio Vienna.
So deeper cuts.
Exactly. It highlights that even his non-album tracks and live sessions were already incredibly valued by listeners who were just hungry for more of that hushed poetry.
Okay, so he's established this lo-fi identity. He scored this massive, unlikely cover hit. And then Beam makes a really significant strategic decision with his second proper album, Our Endless Numbered Days, in 2004.
Yeah, this is where he consciously decides to step up the production fidelity.
A big move.
A huge move. This marked the first major transition away from that pure four-track aesthetic. He deliberately moved out of the home studio, recorded in a professional studio in Chicago, working with a producer, Brian Deck.
Right.
And the sources are very clear. This resulted in a significant increase in fidelity. Cleaner sound, basically.
Was that a risk, though? Moving into a clean studio, did it risk kind of compromising the intimate, slightly messy feel that had made him successful?
Oh, it was definitely a strategic risk. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But you could argue it was necessary for growth. I mean, the lo-fi sound was great for those early recordings. But Beam's ambition as a songwriter was clearly growing. Increased fidelity allowed him to start adding layers, cleaner background vocals, maybe some subtle percussion, without the recording just turning into mud or losing clarity to the noise floor.
Right. You can hear more detail.
Exactly. It allowed the songwriting, which was always the core strength, to finally kind of breathe in a wider, cleaner sonic space.
And the band started to grow around this time too, right? It wasn't just him anymore.
That's another key part. While the focus remained heavily acoustic, the inclusion of other band members was a definite departure from the pure solo four-track approach. It signaled, as the sources say, a slightly different sound.
So a conscious evolution.
Absolutely. This was the sound of an intimate folk artist learning how to command a proper studio space. And the commercial results, they totally justified the shift.
How did it do?
Our Endless Number Days was certified RIAA Gold. Over 200,000 sales in the U.S. And crucially, the track Naked As We Came from that album also achieved RIAA Gold certification on its own.
Wow. So the audience came with him.
They did. It proved that the core audience appreciated the cleaned up sound. The fidelity jump didn't dilute the intimacy of the performance for them. It actually expanded his reach.
Okay, so the progression really starts to accelerate dramatically after 2004, after that second album. Beam starts injecting like way more new textures, more thematic complexity, moving Iron and Wine into this realm of true genre blending and bigger collaborations.
Yeah, this period kicks off almost immediately with the Woman King EP in 2005. Musically, you hear him broadening the sound right away with the clear addition of electric guitars.
Okay, a textural shift away from just pure acoustic folk.
Definitely. But the thematic ambition grew just as much. The Woman King EP is fascinating because, well, each track focuses on a spiritual female figure, and they all have these explicit biblical overtones.
Interesting. So getting more complex lyrically, too.
Yeah, this complexity starts to set the stage for the deeply literate kind of searching songwriting he'd become known for.
Yeah.
You see him connecting that Southern Bible-belt upbringing with his artistic curiosity.
And while Iron and Wine is fundamentally Stan Beam, the project was becoming more of a, like, family affair, too.
That's a good point. We should definitely mention his sister, Sarah Beam. She contributed backing vocals on a lot of the studio recordings and performed live with him quite a bit. Her vocal harmonies became a really integral part of...
Boost your self-care routine this fall with Fresh Thyme Market's Vitamins and Body Care Sale. Take advantage of big savings and enjoy 30% off all wellness items department-wide from Wednesday, October 15th to Tuesday, the 21st. Take better care of you and your wallet with savings on nourishing skincare, immune-boosting supplements, and plant-based protein powder. Stop by your neighborhood Fresh Thyme Market today, where healthy living is made easy.
That expanding Iron and Wine sound, adding this second layer of quiet intimacy.
Nice. But the really crucial collaborative step, the one that really changed the sound, was connecting with Calexico, right?
Oh, absolutely, Calexico. This Arizona-based rock band, they specialize in this unique, really rich fusion of Southwestern rock, traditional Mexican music influences, and subtle jazz touches. They're known for these cinematic, expansive soundscapes.
So totally different from Beam's initial sound?
Totally different. In 2005, they released the In the Rains EP together. And what's amazing is that Beam had actually written the basic songs years earlier.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but Calexico took those existing folk skeletons and just draped them in these complex, entirely new arrangements. It forced Beam, the quiet folk artist, to sing within a much more dynamic, rhythmic framework than he ever had before.
So how exactly did that Calexico fusion change the texture? What did they bring that just wasn't there in Iron and Wine before?
Well, they brought rhythm, for one, dynamics, color. They introduced instruments that were totally foreign to that four-track era.
Oh.
Things like vibraphone, pedal steel, and crucially, brass instruments, horns.
Brass and Iron and Wine, that's a big shift.
Huge. You can hear it perfectly on the track, Burn That Broken Bed. The melancholic folk melody is still there, but it's underpinned by these almost mariachi-adjacent rhythms and these sweeping trumpet lines. It's a massive stylistic divergence. It really showed Beam was comfortable letting go of some control to explore new genres.
So that successful partnership, that EP, it must have laid the groundwork for his next full album, right? The Shepherd's Dog in 2007?
Absolutely. It laid the deep foundation for The Shepherd's Dog, which became a real high watermark, both commercially and critically.
How so?
Critically acclaimed Paste magazine voted it one of the 10 best albums of 2007. Commercially, it also hit RIA Gold, about 197,000 U.S. sales. And the list of contributors on this album, it reads like a perfect synthesis of his career up to that point.
Who was on it?
You had Calexico members Joey Burns and Paul Niehaus back again. But alongside them, you had bona fide jazz veterans, like bassist Matt Lux and the multi-instrumentalist Bob Berger.
Okay, bringing in actual jazz musicians now, that seems like a very deliberate strategic choice. What does incorporating a genuine jazz rhythm section, rather than just, say, a standard rock one, bring to his kind of songs?
Oh, it adds incredible sophistication.
Mm-hmm.
Complexity in the groove. Jazz musicians, they don't just keep time, right? They often use syncopation, unexpected flourishes, dynamic shifts. It makes the music feel restless, constantly evolving underneath the melody.
So it adds another layer of depth.
Exactly. It allowed Beam to really expand the emotional landscape of the songs. They weren't just, you know, sad folk songs anymore. They felt like these expansive searching compositions, much bigger.
And the thematic ambitions seemed to match that sonic breadth, too. There's a fascinating quote in the sources about the inspiration for The Shepherd's Dog, tying the music to the political climate of the time.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Beam specifically noted that while the album was, quote, not a political propaganda record, it was, quote, definitely inspired by political confusion. He said, because I was really taken aback when Bush got reelected.
So the music reflects that feeling.
It seems like it. That lush, layered, complex new soundscape with all these diverse textures and rhythms was being used to carry this heavier, more confusing, complex emotional weight.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like a perfect match between the form and the function, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. Before we move into the major label period, we should probably mention that Beam was also pretty active in expanding his catalog outside of the official albums too, right? Compiling B-sides and stuff.
Absolutely. That compilation, Around the Well, came out in 2009. It really demonstrated the sheer depth of polished material he'd created, even in those early years, highlighting just how productive he was outside of the main album cycle.
Lots of material there.
Tons. And furthermore, he was using his growing profile for charitable causes, too. He contributed a really powerful song, Stolen Houses Die, to the Big AIDS benefit album, Dark Was the Night. That collaborative spirit was definitely running high, kind of preparing him for the biggest move yet, which was just around the corner.
Okay, now we enter the phase where Iron and Wine really becomes a major player on the charts. And this coincides with his move to a major label. This feels like the official pop crossover peak.
Yeah, this really kicks off with the album Kiss Each Other Clean in 2011, released on Warner Bros. Records in North America, and 4AD still handled it globally. But that move to Warner Bros., that signifies a massive step up in terms of industry backing, distribution, marketing muscle.
Definitely. And with this album, Beam made a pretty clear strategic choice sonically, didn't he? Blending his established folk style with something else.
Yeah, with a much stronger, more accessible pop influence. That was the key descriptor.
Okay, let's talk about the potential risk there. Was there concern among his, you know, loyal Sub Pop fan base that moving to a huge label like Warner Bros. Would inevitably, like, dilute the intimacy he was known for, water it down?
Oh, that risk is always present when an indie darling goes major. Always.
Yeah.
But I think Beam navigated it pretty skillfully by leaning into the arrangements. Stronger pop influence here meant clearer hooks, maybe lusher backing vocals, more polished instrumental clarity.
That's still him.
Yeah, all while retaining his distinct lyrical voice. He wasn't just chasing trends, you know. It felt more like he was using the major label budget to finally achieve the kind of orchestral sonic ambitions he'd been hinting at ever since that first Calexico EP, Bigger Sounds.
And the charts seemed to immediately validate that decision.
Right. Instantly. This album gave him his highest U.S. chart position ever. It peaked at an impressive #2 on the Billboard 200.
Number two. Wow.
Yeah. The commercial success was undeniable. About 125,000 U.S. sales reported. This is really the moment the lo-fi film professor officially joins the ranks of chart-topping artists. It proved you could be both intimate and popular on a large scale.
But he didn't just settle into that pop sound, did he? His next album, Ghost on Ghost, in 2013, kept pushing things.
Exactly. He didn't just rest there. Ghost on Ghost continued that path of deep sonic experimentation. And significantly, it was released on None Such Records.
And None Such, right. Known for a pretty diverse roster, classical, jazz, world music.
Exactly. A label known for quality and diversity. Ghost on Ghost continued exploring pop sounds, sure, but it added these really notable jazz and R&B influences into the mix, more overtly than before.
And this wasn't just like adding a jazzy guitar chord here or there. The sources confirmed this deeper dive by mentioning a specific contributor, right? A legendary jazz drummer.
Yes. Brian Blade played drums on the album.
Brian Blade. Known for working with Joni Mitchell, Wayne Shorter. I mean, that's serious jazz cred.
That specific personnel choice tells you everything about the intentionality of the sound. Brian Blade brings this incredibly intricate, subtle, fluid, rhythmic sense that, you know, standard folk or rock drumming just doesn't offer.
So it changed the feel.
Completely. Mm-hmm. By incorporating these R&B and jazz grooves, Beam moved the focus from simple folk rhythm to these complex underlying structures. The music started to swing more, in a way. It demanded a different way of listening, almost. All while his voice remained that hushed, familiar anchor right on top.
This era is also really defined by his ongoing commitment to external collaborations. They seem to act as, like, creative fuel for him.
Absolutely. Can't talk about this period without the collaborations. In 2015, he released Sing Into My Mouth, which was a covers album recorded with Ben Bridwell.
From Band of Horses, bringing that connection full circle from the Discovery story.
Exactly. And that partnership actually continued recently with a 2025 covers EP called Making Good Time. So that relationship endured.
And he didn't stop there with collabs, did he?
Nope. He paired up with the American singer-songwriter Jessica Hoop for Love Letter for Fire in 2016, an entire album of duets.
Wow.
And again, look at the caliber of musicians playing on that record. Wilco's drummer Glenn Kache, the keyboardist Rob Berger. It just illustrates how highly regarded Beam had become among these top-tier, often experimental musicians across the indie spectrum.
People wanted to work with him.
Clearly. And then the real full-circle moment occurred in 2019 when Iron and Wine and Calexico reunited for Years to Burn.
Their first full collaboration album since that really formative In the Rain's EP way back in 2005.
Exactly. It proved that blend of Southwestern rock, jazz and folk wasn't just some temporary experiment for him. It was a successful template he could return to, something core to his expanded sound.
Okay, but then after hitting these heights of collaboration and chart success and sonic complexity, Beam made another really interesting move, almost like a course correction, a purposeful strip back to simplicity.
Yeah, it's fascinating. The 2017 album, Beast Epic, marked a return to his original label, Sub Pop.
Back to Sub Pop.
Right. And a very conscious decision to, as the sources note, strip back the production and array of instruments that were so prevalent on the previous highly layered records.
Why? What was the goal?
The stated goal was clear.
Hmm.
To focus again on more simple and melodic song structures. It feels like a remarkable return to basics, but maybe informed by all the wisdom gained from those years of genre experimentation.
So it's like the mature songwriter choosing simplicity, not the amateur songwriter settling for it out of necessity, like on the debut.
Exactly. That's a great way to put it. It's simplicity by choice, not limitation.
And the work continues today, right? He's still active.
Very active. Iron and Wine released their 7th studio album, Light Verse, just this year in 2024. And alongside it, a really beautiful cover of American football's emo classic Never Meant. So he's still exploring both original material and covers.
And you also have to highlight his commitment to archiving his own history, right? Through the archive series.
Oh yeah, that's crucial for understanding his whole trajectory. This ongoing project, started back in 2015 with Volume 1, features unreleased songs recorded during the same early period as his debut. Stuff that didn't make the cut then.
So like alternate takes or lost tracks.
Exactly. And later archival releases, like Volume 5 from 2021, included unreleased songs recorded in Tallahassee way back in 1998, even before the first album. He's essentially giving the listener the full academic and creative timeline of his development, showing where the roots of his massive sound truly began, back in those even earlier unheard tapes.
Okay, so the artistic evolution of Iron and Wine is obviously compelling on its own, but the commercial reality is that his music has achieved this massive profile boost through really consistent, high-impact placement in film and television. His music has just proven incredibly versatile for shaping emotional scenes.
That's the genius of his sound, I think. Whether it's the super lo-fi early stuff or the later lush arrangements, that core intimacy is always there. It makes a perfect emotional shorthand for media.
Yeah.
His songs have been featured in major films like In Good Company that use the trapeze swinger, and of course, famously, Garden State with Such Great Heights.
And on television, his music just became the soundtrack for so many complex, dramatic moments. Hit series like Grey's Anatomy, The L Word, House MD, they all used his stuff to underscore intense character development.
He was also really heavily featured on Friday Night Lights, which used multiple tracks. I remember Upward Over the Mountain, and even one of the really early lo-fi tracks, Dead Man's Will, popping up on that show.
But the single biggest driver, the one that probably pushed him into the stratosphere in terms of commercial profile and certifications, it has to be the Twilight Effect, right?
Oh, undoubtedly. The track Flightless Bird, American Mouth, It was specifically chosen for that pivotal prom scene in the first Twilight film.
And the sources actually confirmed this wasn't just some random music supervisor pick either. Apparently the female lead, Kristen Stewart, specifically chose that song for the scene. Yeah, demonstrating how deeply the music resonated with the emotional context the film needed right at that moment.
That kind of placement just sends a song into the global consciousness, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Elevating his profile into the true mass mainstream like never before. Flightless Bird, American Mouth, is now RIAA Platinum certified.
Platinum. That's over 1 million units.
1 million units. And it's also BPI Silver certified over in the UK. And then a slightly different wedding version of the same song was even used in the sequel, Twilight Saga, Breaking Dawn Part 1. They couldn't get enough of it.
So if we just quickly summarize his certified success metrics, it really underscores the scale of this career that started on a borrowed four-track machine. We're looking at, what, 5 certified tracks total?
Yeah. Such Great Heights, Gold, Boy with a Coin, Bold, call it Dreaming, Gold, and Naked as We Came, Gold, plus that huge platinum track, Flightless Bird, American Mouth.
That is a massive commercial catalog built on a foundation of essentially quiet folk music. It's pretty incredible.
It really is.
Yeah.
And before we wrap up, we really have to touch on this deep, almost contradictory layer of Beam's personal philosophy that seems to profoundly inform his lyrical content. It's this tension between his religious background and his current agnosticism.
Right. He was raised Christian in the Bible Belt,
right,
which is precisely why his music, especially stuff like the Woman King EP, is often just filled with biblical allusions, religious symbolism, spiritual language,
mm-hmm.
yet he now identifies as agnostic.
And this is the crucial point, I think, for analyzing his poetry.
Mm.
He uses the language of his upbringing, which is this shared, powerful, dramatic vocabulary built on parables and ancient symbols, not necessarily to profess belief.
But to do what?
But to search, to question. It's a language set that's inherently dramatic and rich with meaning, and he wields it masterfully for exploration.
He gave a really insightful quote about this nuanced view, didn't he?
Yeah, he said, "I don't miss being misled. I'm not an atheist. There's an undeniable unseen world that some people call God and think they know more about than other people. I try not to get hung up on the names."
Try not to get hung up on the names. That's great.
It perfectly captures it. This stance of agnostic curiosity rather than rigid belief or, you know, cynical rejection
yep.
seems to be the very engine for his most profound lyrics. It gives his poetry that seeking, yearning, questioning quality.
Yeah, the listener feels that lack of certainty, which maybe makes the songs feel more universally relatable somehow.
Exactly. On a final personal note, just to ground him again, Beam currently lives in Durham, North Carolina, with his wife Kim and their five daughters. Still keeps a relatively grounded life, despite all the fame.
And just to connect things all the way back to his origins as a visual artist, the painter.
Right.
The sources note that back in 2011, a portrait of Beam was painted by the British artist Joe Simpson.
Yeah.
And it was exhibited around the UK, including at the Royal Albert Hall.
Wow. So he achieved prominence in the visual world, too, in a way.
Yeah. Coming full circle again. #tagtrack OETRO, synthesis and final thought. So what does this all mean for us, for you, the learner? We've traced this remarkable, almost unbelievable trajectory, haven't we? We went from Samuel Irvin Beam, the film professor, recording these intensely intimate acoustic tracks on a borrowed four-track,
mm-hmm.
to a chart-topping, platinum-selling artist who's synthesizing folk, pop, jazz, R&B, all under this name, inspired by a nutritional supplement he found in a general store.
Yeah, the synthesis here, I think, is that the evolution of iron and wine really proves that an increase in production fidelity, getting a bigger sound, doesn't have to dilute the emotional intimacy of the music. It's not a zero-sum game.
Right.
Instead, Beam's very deliberate sonic evolution, which you can argue was informed by the rigor of his academic cinematic background, allowed him to perfectly match his soundscape to the growing ambition, the complexity, and just the sheer scope of his mature songwriting.
He knew when to whisper.
Exactly. And he knew when his message, his feeling, required the weight of a full brass section or the intricate subtlety of a master jazz drummer like Brian Blade.
It feels like the journey of an artist who knew precisely how to use the studio and all the musicians within it as this massive canvas for expression. He learned to paint with sound on a grand scale.
Precisely. So we've seen his musical journey from that solitary intimacy to these lush, layered arrangements. But one of the most compelling takeaways, I think, loops back to that personal contradiction we discussed. So many of his tracks carry these deep spiritual themes or biblical allusions, despite his stated agnosticism.
Yeah.
So the final thought for you to chew on is this. What stands out to you? How does this tension, this use of powerful religious language as a tool for deep spiritual curiosity, but without necessarily adhering to dogma, how does that define the unique searching quality of his lyrics? Think about that. Now, maybe go explore how that contrast plays out specifically on an album like The Shepherd's Dog, or go back to the Woman King EP and listen with that tension in mind.